Today is Thursday, May 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
The task is enormous, and the challenge is even more. About 150 scientists have worked to establish a detailed assessment of the current state of global diversity.
That's reporter Nico Pinot in Paris. We'll have the full story coming up. Also ahead, we'll have a live report from Capitol Hill on the latest on U.S. Attorney General William Barr and the psychology behind the parents involved in the U.S. college cheating scandal. It's all on today's International Edition. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro today called on the country's armed forces to oppose any coup plotter after opposition leader Juan Guaido failed to win defections from military leaders. Guaido, supported by a small group of defecting security forces, on Tuesday called for a massive uprising against Maduro. Guaido, the National Assembly leader, declared himself the country's interim president in January. The U.S. and about 50 other countries recognize him as the legitimate leader of the South American nation. A Guaido supporter yesterday told VOA's Spanish service journalist in Caracas the Venezuelan people filled the streets with their leader, Leopoldo López, and Guaido, the legitimate president. But thousands of President Maduro supporters were also on the streets. Vilma Fuentes says they are here to thank the government of Maduro and former President Hugo Chavez, and that the labor class supports the president. Also, Donna Shalala, a Democrat Party member of Congress, emphasized to VOA Spanish service the importance of a peaceful transition. However, she said Congress backs President Trump's threats of a harsh response to countries that support Maduro.
We want a peaceful transition, and squeezing the Cubans, the Russians, the Iranians, anyone who's interfering with the politics of Venezuela and with the legitimate leader, Juan Guaido, will squeeze them until they leave and let a peaceful transition and elections take place.
Guaido said a staggered industrial action would start today, leading to a general strike. Well, United States House Judiciary Committee Chairman Gerald Nadler said Attorney General William Barr's moment of accountability will come soon enough after refusing to comply with demands related to a report on a probe into Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election. Nadler, a Democrat, said during an abbreviated hearing today that Barr has failed to stand up to the president and address this clear and present danger to our constitutional order. The committee's ranking Republican Doug Collins argued the Democrats didn't want him here today and added the stunt and the circus continues over here. Barr testified for hours before a Senate committee yesterday about his decision to not declare the president had obstructed justice and for his oversight of the end of Mueller's report. Well, joining me live from Capitol Hill is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. And thank you so much for joining me, Catherine.
You're so very welcome.
Well, Catherine, understand that the Democrats are now demanding for Barr to resign or to have him impeached. What is really going on right now?
That's right. We're hearing a mix of reaction from House Democrats today after the Attorney General chose to cancel that appearance before the panel earlier this morning. What some of the Democrats are saying is that they want to see these negotiations for Barr to appear and to release an unredacted version of the Mueller report continue before they push for his impeachment and push for a subpoena, which really would be extraordinary in terms of the relationship between the executive branch and the Congress.
And what is the underlying reason that they're continuing with this?
Well, they're pushing for an unredacted version of the Mueller report. They want to see all of the material relating to that special counsel investigation, and they want to be able to question the Attorney General about that report and about his dealings, about that summary that our listeners may remember that he released to the American public that summarized the Mueller report before the before the redacted report came out to the public. There's been some back and forth about whether the special counsel was upset about the attorney general's summarization of that report.
So do you think that the Democrats will be able to question him?
That is a fascinating question, and really we're in unprecedented ground here. There's just been a sense over the past few days up here on Capitol Hill that this conflict between the White House and Congress is really reaching a breaking point on a number of levels, and that the conflict with Attorney General Barr is just the latest in that conflict. I think that eventually you may see some sort of negotiation worked out. That's how it's always worked out in the past. But as I said, we're really in uncharted territory, and we could be looking at a subpoena soon.
Now, some observers are looking at this saying that this is being done intentionally to lead up to the 2020 elections. Do you get that feeling up on Capitol Hill?
Right. You know, I was just in a press conference with House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who said that very thing. He said that this is because Republicans don't have the guts to impeach the president and that they want to provoke this kind of reaction. They want to keep this issue coming back up. And that, frankly, according to his viewpoint, the American people are ready to move on now that the Mueller report has been released.
So what is the next step at this point?
So the negotiations will be ongoing, but Chairman Nadler of the House Judiciary Committee said that if they aren't settled within the next few days, he is willing to send out a subpoena for Attorney General Barr. This is really unprecedented, I have to say. And he really outlined the stakes, saying that the constitutional checks and balances that have been in place in our democracy for decades, for centuries, are really at stake here and that the American people deserve more.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for that insight. That's VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson, who was live on Capitol Hill. Among the top stories in the world, Human Rights Watch says Chinese authorities are using a mass surveillance app to profile, investigate, and detain Muslims in the northwestern region of Xinjiang. British Prime Minister Theresa May fires her defense minister, saying there is compelling evidence he was the source of leaked information from a secret meeting about Chinese telecommunications company Huawei. And the U.S. is tightening its economic sanctions on Iran by ending a set of waivers today that had allowed some of the country's largest oil buyers to continue their purchases. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Well, a recent admissions scandal revealed very rich parents bought test scores and favors to gain their children's admission to several U.S. colleges and universities. Lately, the family of a Chinese student allegedly paid $6.5 million to the ringleader of the college admissions scandal to get their daughter into Stanford University. Other parents paid either hundreds of thousands of dollars, some up to $1 million, to ensure their children were admitted to these prestigious colleges and universities. Well, joining me live here in the studio is VOA's education editor, Kathleen Strzok. Kathleen, thank you so much for joining me, and you've been covering this story for us. And can you first of all just give us a quick summary of what happened?
Sure. In mid-March, the U.S. Department of Justice handed down 50 indictments, 50 people whom they said were involved in this admissions scandal. Parents had paid from tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands, up to $6.5 million to Rick Singer of Newport Beach, California, who kind of organized this small network of getting these children into prestigious schools. And just to be clear, the universities weren't part of this. It was this ringleader who was taking money from parents to have the SATs taken for them to get special compensation, for them to appear as if they were super sports stars, either in sailing or fencing or whatever. And that way, the school would accept that student under false pretense.
Now, this latest revelation of the $6.5 million that was paid out by a Chinese family, This is quite a revelation. That's a lot of money. So can you kind of talk about that?
Sure. When the indictments came down in March, it named who the parents were, and it separately said, you know, how many the amounts that had been spent, but the two weren't connected. So a lot of people were thinking, well, who paid $6.5 million to get their kid into a prestigious school? So it came out this week that two Chinese families had, one family had paid $6.5 million to get their student into Stanford, and she was admitted into their sailing program. So this again happened through the sports coach. She was portrayed as someone who was very skilled in sailing, and Stanford just had to have her on their team. The other student's family paid $1.2 million to get her into Yale University in Connecticut. These, of course, are extremely prestigious universities in the United States and very, very coveted by international students.
Now, you mentioned that the universities were not involved, but when you have sports and there's coaches, there's a coach involved, how could the coach not be involved?
Right. Well, how could the university not be involved? That's a really good question. Yeah. A lot of people don't realize that at many schools, colleges, and universities, it's the sports coach who gets paid more sometimes than the president or the chancellor, because the sports coaches will bring in stars. You know, look at basketball, look at college basketball. These kids will come into school, they'll be superstars, there'll be a lot of endorsements, a lot of money is raised for that university. And then that young person goes on to work professionally and, you know, becomes a multimillionaire and a star and so on and so forth. So sometimes the sports coaches and recruiters act almost as if free agents. They're employed by the university, but they kind of have their own universe to do what they want.
And what is the mindset of parents, especially of foreign students, to get their kids in schools here?
Well, that, again, a very good question. There are families all over the world and in the United States who want to be able to achieve success, and they want their children to have success by going to a good school. If you go to a good school, you get a good education, you get a good job. There's plenty of studies to show that that's very effective. If you have Harvard, Yale, University of Southern California, which is involved in this, if you have that on your resume and you go for a job, you're going to rise to the top of the pile. So this is something that families really, really want for their kids. If you're a wealthy family, you want your kid to go to the best school.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. We'll continue to follow this story. Thank you so much, Kathleen Strzok, who is VOA's education editor.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Well, India has evacuated more than 300,000 people along its northeast coastline by boat, bus, and train ahead of a severe cyclone due to make landfall early tomorrow, with many villagers piling household possessions onto trucks before fleeing their homes. Cyclone Fani has been churning up the Bay of Bengal toward the Hindu temple town of Puri, where special trains were put in service to evacuate tourists and the beaches were empty. About 1.2 million people are expected to be evacuated from low-lying areas of 15 districts in the eastern state of Odisha to cyclone shelters, schools, and other buildings, authorities have said. And Catholic church leaders in Sri Lanka have canceled Sunday services for another week, citing what they said are specific security concerns following attacks last month at churches and hotels that killed more than 250 people. A spokesman for the Colombo Diocese made the announcement today that, based on new information, churches would not be resuming services as they had planned to on Sunday. Last week, Cardinal Malcolm Ranjith conducted a private memorial mass that was broadcast on television. Authorities have blamed the Easter Sunday attacks on a local militant group called National Tawheed Jamaat, which pledged allegiance with the Islamic State group. And officials from 132 nations have been gathering in Paris to look at the state of biodiversity around the world. The meeting is the seventh session of the Intergovernmental Science and Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, which will culminate with the presentation of a huge report when the meeting concludes on May 4th. As Nico Pinot reports from Paris, experts are alarmed by the destruction that they are seeing.
The task is enormous, and the challenge is even more. About 150 scientists have worked to establish a detailed assessment of the current state of global diversity. The 1800-page report, the first inventory in 15 years, is expected to become a scientific reference in biodiversity. A quarter of the 100,000 species assessed, a tiny portion of the estimated 8 million on Earth, are already threatened with extinction. But an imminent rapid acceleration in the rate of species extinction is expected by scientists, according to the draft report. And between 500,000 and 1 million are expected to become threatened, including many in the coming decades. The roots of the problem are well known: climate change and human activities. In 2018, a World Wildlife Fund report indicated that half of wildlife species have disappeared in just 40 years. Deforestation, pesticide use, fishing are among the culprits. The report alleges that human activity as a whole is responsible for 60% decline in global wildlife between 1970 and 2014. Thomas Brooks is the International Union for Conservation of Nature's chief scientist.
The conversion and the destruction of natural habitats, conversion, for example, for agriculture, and also by direct exploitation of animals and plants, for example, through hunting and fishing and forestry.
The warning from scientists and officials gathering here is that by destroying their own planet, people are also threatening mankind and hurting people. Bob Watson is the chairman of the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services.
The continued loss of biodiversity will undermine the ability of most countries to achieve most of the Sustainable Development Goals. In particular, it will undermine our ability for poverty reduction, food and water security, human health, and the overall goal of leaving nobody behind.
Thomas Brooks believes rich and poor nations must share the burden of the current situation.
The loss of living nature, the loss of biodiversity, is something that has dramatic and negative implications for all people in all countries. It is well documented that the most severe impacts of the loss of biodiversity are felt by the people who have the fewest resources to be able to respond to those losses.
This gathering is the first of several events to put the ecosystem at the center of discussions. The next is the G7 at the end of August in Biarritz, chaired by France, which wants to put biodiversity on the agenda. Nico Pino for VOA News, Paris.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com. Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Well, today is International Holocaust Remembrance Day, a day many see as a reminder to never forget. However, it also comes as the world is seeing a rise in anti-Semitism. International Edition's Lori London talks to Rabbi Terry Bookman, who has visited the Holocaust Museum in Kigali, Rwanda, about why this day is more important than ever.
When it was decided that there would be a special day for Holocaust Memorial, it wasn't a unanimous feeling in the Jewish world. There was a kind of a split. Some felt that it should be put on Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, where we commemorate the destruction of the temple and other horrible things, as one of a series of things that happened to the Jewish people. And others felt that the enormity, the numbers were so great that it needed its own special day. And so that latter feeling won out.
And there are very few survivors left now, so I would think that that would sort of add
even more importance to taking a day to think about it and remember it, although there are certainly descendants of the Holocaust, not too many left that lived through it.
Judaism is bound up with memory. It's a thread that weaves its way through a lot. We are commanded to remember all sorts of things. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Remember just the Passover. Remember that you were slaves. Remember the stranger in your midst because you were strangers. And now what we're talking about is remember the Holocaust. But memory in Judaism is not an end unto itself. And it's not about dwelling in the past, nor is it an agenda item in and of itself. Really, every act of memory is attached to either an ethical or spiritual component. And so in remembering the Holocaust, the next words that should come to mind is never again. And never again is not about just the Jewish people. It's really that this kind of act of genocide should never be perpetrated against any people.
And I understand you also visited Rwanda and went to the Holocaust Museum in Kigali. Certainly what they went through was horrific.
And I was very moved by it because here in this small African nation, which still in recovery from a horrific genocide, I walked into this museum, and of course they commemorated their own genocide, but then in successive rooms there was memorials to the other genocide, Armenian genocide, the Cambodian genocide, and of course the Jewish Holocaust as well. And that was really powerful in that it didn't totally focus just on themselves, but it focused on the act of genocide of one people against another and brought all of them together. And it was very, very powerful. And I kind of wish that we had that and there's so many Jewish museums commemorating the Holocaust, and I can't think of one of them that actually also shares the pain and suffering of other peoples. I wish there was.
Is there a theme this year?
It basically is that theme, but again, because of the uptick in anti-Semitic act, I think it's kind of becoming the focus of a lot of the commemorations of Yom HaShoah, as it's called in Hebrew. And there is something good about that, and that it draws attention, but there's a danger in it as well, in equivocation, because what we're seeing today is an uptick in anti-Semitic actions, but we're not really seeing anti-Semitism. And I know that some people think I'm equivocating, but there really is a huge difference between what happened in Germany, where there was a systematic government-led genocide against the Jewish people versus the acts of individuals, which are largely condemned by law enforcement, and what we see in all of these horrific actions, the community coming together. I mean, after Pittsburgh, you know, Muslims, Christians all joined together. And after this latest attack in California, my imam friend called me to see if I was doing okay. That's not anti-Semitism anymore. This is the actions of haters. Dangerous tropes have kind of encouraged this kind of behavior, and it's worldwide, not just here in the United States.
That was Rabbi Terry Bookman speaking with International Edition's Lori London. You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Sidrak Franklin. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Scientists say for about the first half of Earth's history, there wasn't enough oxygen in the atmosphere to support complex life. Then between 2.3 and 2.5 billion years ago, a process called the Great Oxidation Event began to create the permanently oxygenated atmosphere that keeps us alive today. Previous research suggested small pockets of oxygen existed in the Earth's shallow oceans years earlier. Now, researchers at Arizona State University say they found evidence that suggests that significant amounts of oxygen were being produced and large-scale oxygenation processes took place in the oceans long before the Great Oxidation Event. Researchers made their findings by analyzing sedimentary rocks that were buried deep underground in Australia. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.